Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the February 2020 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Christopher Madej, Program Director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA Program in Memphis, Tennessee.
And I'm your co-host, Adrian Banning, faculty member, research coordinator, and EBM course director at the Drexel PA program in Philadelphia.
So this month, we feature CME articles on multiple sclerosis, complementary feeding in infants, a QRS on skin cancer, and a review article on the use of ultrasound in long bone fractures.
Looking forward to it.
Yep.
But first, we have to do our question from the editor. We get to do our question from the editor. And it's this from Harrison. While the vast majority of PAs practice in clinical roles, many of us also work in education, research, administration, leadership, and a variety of other realms. Many PAs also hold positions that are combinations or hybrids of these roles. Describe a PA position or role, existing or hypothetical, that you think would most benefit the PA profession and healthcare as a whole. You go, Chris.
So I think a good PA is both patient-centered as well as team-centered. And I think the perfect role for a practicing PA for the PA profession would be somebody who not only is participating in patient care, but is also the team leader, so to speak, of helping coordinate services between our physician colleagues, our nursing colleagues, our therapy colleagues, our pharmacist colleagues, but basically sort of being that maestro, if you will, of the patient care because we kind of fit that bill and can work with all of those professions individually. And I think ultimately that also addresses the healthcare as a whole for the patient because most patients don't know the inner workings of the healthcare system. So if we can help them navigate and maybe serve as their navigator through the healthcare system, again, it's patient-centered but also interprofessional team-centered where we are the person that is sort of helping coordinate both the team aspect as well as the patient aspect. So that's kind of my take on that.
So would you go to school for that?
You know, I think the educator in me would love to have more instruction on those types of skills, whether it's communication skills, whether it's just introduction to other professions, not just checking that IPE box for accreditation, but really saying, look, here's a course where we interact with all of these other professions so that when we get out in practice, we have an idea of what all of these professions are doing. So I don't think it would necessarily be something extra a more schooling. It would be more of just maybe tailoring some of the approach in PA programs to help address that a little bit more directly.
I really like this question. I mean, I think that many of us are doing this and doing what you describe kind of just naturally without it actually being identified. I would like if we started to do kind of some, I think the more dual degrees, I think that the public health and PA dual degree is pretty popular. I've seen a business and PA dual degree, MBA. What I haven't seen a ton of and I think is important is a PhD and PA. So that we're really part of the kind of scientific conversation. There are MD PhDs, and I'd like to see, and there are PhD nurses. I'd like to see more formal PA PhD or any formal PA PhD. That's the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah, and I was actually having this conversation with my wife, who's a clinical counselor, and she has a master's of arts in counseling and education. And I was thinking, that's also a potential one where if you know you want to either bolster your skills in being able to interact with patients or want to go into a mental health field, this could, again, be another avenue of a dual degree where you get your PA master's as well as a master's in counseling because that's the realm of medicine that you want to go to practice in. So I think the door is wide open, and I think it's more just having conversations at your local institutions, for those of you that are educators, to really talk about what are some things that we can try to partner with where it's not just do A and then B, but maybe do a little bit of A and then A and B kind of go concurrently because some of the stuff that we teach can count towards the credits of this. And then maybe the clinical hours that you have to do for PA can also count towards the clinical hours for this other thing if we do it in this way. And so I think you get creative with it, and I think you really start to develop these interesting hybrid type roles.
And I think if you're a PA who sees that you're already doing a role like this, call more attention to it. Or if you need more training, that would have been great as you were going through PA school. Or now, raise your voice. You can tell AAPA and PAEA or get it going yourself. But you're the one who's out there who sees the need and sees what you're doing. So maybe the next hybrid role is something that you're going to tell us about instead of vice versa.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So great question, Harrison, as always. That's always fun to kind of dive into our brains a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps open us up a little bit more, too.
Mm-hmm. True.
So, disclaimer, the podcast is a summary of select articles from this month's edition, and we share our take and opinions, but they don't represent JAPA, the authors, the editors, or the publisher's opinions, and it is not intended as medical advice.
Mm-mm. But it is intended for you to read the articles and get CME. So a reminder is that when you read both CME articles, review the post-test, and then take the online test at cme.aapa.org, and you get at least 70%, you get one Category 1 CME. So don't forget to go and get your CME. Our first CME article, speaking of, is a big one. It's a great one. It's A Current Understanding of Multiple Sclerosis. And this is by Catherine Schuhl, Brittany Hoyle, Kaylin Iannotta, Eden Fletcher, Megan Curran, and Victoria Cipollone. And Catherine Schuhl is an assistant professor in the PA program at Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and practices at Wake Forest Baptist Health Family Medicine. And at the time this article was written, the rest of our authors were all students in the PA program at Wake Forest, and they have no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So this is really an updated overview of MS. I highly recommend that you read the article because I only have the time here to give you just a dip into the water of what this covers. But it was a great comprehensive article reminding us first that MS is an autoimmune inflammatory disorder or neurologic disease of the neurons where the myelin sheath covering of the nerve degrades. And I always thought, aside, they don't say this analogy in the article, that the myelin sheath, this kind of fatty covering of the nerve, is a little bit like the rubber covering of an electrical wire, like up on the telephone poles. And so if you're taking out these big chunks of the rubber covering, of the plastic covering on the electrical wire, you can imagine how the electricity is not going to go through the wire as it should. And it's the same. The myelin sheath being degraded changes how the neurons and the nerves are communicating with each other and how they even send those signals back and forth. So consider it in anyone under 50 who has spontaneously resolving neurosymptoms that last days to weeks. And this is a disease where symptoms are divided by both space and time, meaning that symptoms occur in different locations of the body as they relate to different locations where the demyelination is occurring in the central nervous system, and they happen at different times. Symptoms come and go, and they happen at different parts. The symptoms totally depend where the lesions are, and that's why there's so many different types of neurosymptoms. We do have a few buzzwords from this article. If you're taking the banner or the pants, you might want to think about these things. You're going to think about multifocal white matter lesions on MRI. You're going to think about the Lermite syndrome, which is shooting pain down the spine and maybe limbs when the neck is flexed. And we also have the Uthoff phenomenon, where exposure to hot temperatures or hot showers can cause optic abnormalities or decrease in vision. So if you see those things described, the writer of the question is probably trying to tell you that this is MS. In 2017, we got a new set of diagnostic criteria for MS and a clarification on the categories. Why does it happen? It seems to happen more in places with less sunshine, and indeed the authors share that low vitamin D is a risk factor, as are genetics, family history, smoking, and early obesity. Vitamin D and smoking cessation don't treat MS, but modifying them can reduce the risk if someone has a positive family history. There are lots of different ways to present since it totally depends on where the lesions are, but fatigue is very common. Up to 80% of people have fatigue, as are eye complaints, very common. And then we get to the four types of MS and one that we're kind of still learning about. So we're not calling that the fifth type, but we're learning a little bit more. Number one, there's relapsing, remitting. So symptoms come and they go. Number two, primary progressive. It comes and then it just gets progressively worse with no relapses. We have secondary progressive. It's initially relapsing, remitting, and then that just becomes a steady decline. And then the fourth one is clinically isolated syndrome, CIS. It's often really just the first episode when another one hasn't happened yet, but it hasn't met the diagnostic criteria for full-blown MS yet. And then that kind of fifth category that I talked about is myelocortical MS. It was defined in 2018, and it involves just the spinal cord and cerebral cortex, but we're learning more about it. The article doesn't go into it more. So first to diagnose, consider what else it might be. Think about Lyme disease, think about HIV, B12 deficiency, thyroid diseases, vasculitis. Then to diagnosis, we want that gadolinium-enhancing T2 MRI of the brain and spinal cord. You're looking for white matter lesions. And to diagnose relapsing remitting, you're looking for lesions separated by space and time, so you need more than one MRI. But since 2017, the McDonald diagnostic criteria were updated from the 2010 version. And they add in 2017 that CSF findings and more broadly localized lesions can now be used for diagnosis. So don't forget about that cerebral spinal fluid in diagnosing MS. Symptomatic and non-symptomatic lesions also now count in the diagnosis, with the exception of optic nerve lesions and optic neuritis. You're going to refer to a specialist team to really manage this disease and manage the disease-modifying therapies, but primary care can ID early and assist in management. It's all about the treatment and support. There's no cure, but we can manage relapses to delay progression and hopefully delay progression. What are you going to do about treatment other than referring, other than specialist teams, disease-modifying therapies for acute or subacute relapses? So symptoms lasting more than 24 hours, patients get a 5-day course of oral steroids like 0.5 mg of methylprednisolone for 5 days, or you can do IV if oral doesn't work or isn't tolerated. And then next are these disease-modifying treatments, DMTs. And the American Association of Neurology outlines guidelines that tell you when to start them, when to switch, when to discontinue. It's beyond the scope of this article because there are so many and they're so different. And there's only one that's not named in the article, actually, that reduces progression of primary progressive. They're all chosen individually based on all the things that you choose a med on, efficacy, safety, monitoring, etc. Don't forget, though, that non-pharm is really important. Cognitive behavioral therapy, protecting the patient's quality of life. It's a really wide specialized team. Basically, anyone that you can think of is going to get on board here. Exercise, mindfulness are all being used as part of successful non-pharm care plans. And to track progress and monitor disability, the authors recommend that the disability status scale, the expanded disability status scale, EDSS, can be used is used to monitor and assess disability from MS. How bad is it going to be is kind of determined. We can make a prognosis by the initial number of lesions present on that T2 MRI and the presence of oligoclonal bands. They're the most important factors for determining recurrence and the debility of MS. Overall, patients with MS have generally a 7 to 14-year decreased life expectancy. And like everything else, if we identify it as soon as possible and get those treatments on board, we can really improve the quality of life, treat the whole person. And like everything else, we need more research on this as well.
Yeah, this is a condition where there is a lot of research being done, mm-hmm. looking at, you know, how does it come on? What are some of the treatments that we can use so that we can try to affect this life expectancy? A lot of these newer biologic agents that are assessing autoimmune conditions may be applicable to multiple sclerosis. So there's so much more coming down the pipeline. It's not all just steroids.
Right.
So if you see patients with MS a lot, you really need to kind of keep your ear to the ground as you're looking at some of that new research that's coming out.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that we still don't know what causes it, which kind of sounds funny sometimes to say, like, yeah, we just still don't really know.
No, I mean, you know, I always remember back to school classically, it's that, you know, degrees of latitude that all the patients are kind of confined in. Like you don't see them in the extremes and, you know, it's kind of just this weird sort of geographical representation, which I don't think is really the case anymore. But it's still, you know, when we were thinking about that 10, 15 years ago, tells you how far we've come and how much further we need to go in understanding this condition.
Yeah, I mean, the best link that we have, like the author said, is that, like, vitamin D sunshine. How much sunshine does someone get? But, yeah, it's a great article. It goes into more detail than we could cover here, so go to the paper. Or to the e-version. Maybe you read the e-version. That's okay.
So the next CME article we're going to touch on is how complementary feeding in infants affects allergies, chronic disease, and neurodevelopment. This is by author Diane Duffy, former director of clinical education and assistant professor in the PA program at Elon University and partner in Burlington, North Carolina Pediatrics. So the definition of complementary feeding is nutrient or energy containing solid or semi-solid foods or liquids that are fed to infants in addition to human milk or formula. So this is just the extra stuff that you're not already giving them for their normal nutrition. And there's a whole host of new current recommendations that I wanted to touch on. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that an infant's need a loss of primitive reflexes of extrusion, suckling, and attainment of truncal stability, as well as the ability to signal satiety in order to be able to then partake of this complementary feeding. If they still have those reflexes intact, they can't sit up, and they don't know when they're full, then they're not cognitively and physiologically development far enough along to be able to do this. So they need to have that intact. And that an infant's GI tract can absorb all the essential nutrients by about 2 to 3 months of age. So the recommendations are to begin introducing foods and complementary foods beginning at around 4 to 6 months of age. The American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as the WHO, recommend exclusively breastfeeding until 6 months of age. And there's some recent evidence to suggest that earlier introduction of allergenic foods may decrease the risk of food allergies in the future. And we'll touch a little bit on that with the LEAP study. The American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology recommends introduction of solid foods at around 4 to 6 months, which again is pretty consistent with the rest of the guidelines. And the European Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition recommends solid foods at 6 months, but no sooner than 17 weeks, so no sooner than 4 months and 4 months and 1 week, and no later than 26 weeks, 6 months and 2 weeks. And the reason is if you do it earlier, it increases the child's risk of obesity later in life. And if you wait until after 6 months, it increases the risk of iron and zinc deficiency. Now, one of the studies that the author quotes in this and really goes into depth, and again, going to the article is really going to be very important to understand this, is the LEAP study, which is Learning Early About Peanut Allergy Study. And what they did was they exposed children to peanuts between 4 and 11 months of age and found that they actually had a decreased risk of peanut allergy later in life. And how they did that was they used peanut puffs and ground them up so that they got about 6 grams of peanuts per day for 3 days a week for about 4 weeks. And that introduction of that actually improved their or decreased their risk of developing food allergies, as well as actually treating eczema and some other atopic dermatitis. So there's a lot that's coming out of this allergen food studies over the last couple years and how it's interplay with nutrition and some of these other conditions. So when you're working with patients and families, what do you tell them? So the recommendations are to begin complementary foods somewhere between 4 to 6 months of age when the child shows that they're developmentally ready to do. You introduce new foods every 3 to 4 days. You try not to add too many foods at once just because if there is a reaction or an allergy, you need to know which one it is. They recommend no juice to children under the 1 year of age, so you really should take all of that out of the equation. And exposure to peanuts 6 months of age in children with eczema actually helps improve their symptoms and their conditions later on in life, both as an adolescent as well as an adult. So there's a lot that actually went into this article that we didn't cover, but it was real heavy in some of the research stuff, and I think you would really benefit to go to check it out. But basically, what do we counsel parents on when they're ready to start to come off a little bit of the breast or bottle feeding, and how do we add it, and what are some of the things that we should be adding?
I think this is one of those times where we've seen medical reversals, right? So I don't know about you, but you know, there were recommendations, I think, let's say 2 generations ago. I think kids ate a lot of what parents ate, and we didn't really think too much about it. We saw this recommendation to avoid things that can be allergenic, and it seems that that just made everything worse, but we were doing our best at the time. And now we know differently. So I remember when these studies came out, like 2015, 2017, and it was kind of related to how popular this Bamba treat is in Israel, right?
Yeah.
And the kids in Israel weren't so so allergic to things, if I'm remembering this correctly. And then they did the studies. And now you can get these at Trader Joe's. Yep. And so I'm a huge peanut butter fan and huge peanut fan in general. So grateful that I don't have allergies. But for those people that do, devastating. And how do we kind of try to minimize that? So I love knowing that we know more and we can do better now.
Yep, as do I.
And I love peanut butter. yeah. Although I didn't have a ton of peanut butter when I was a kid, my mother hates peanut butter. We had almond butter. Ugh, not my favorite.
Fluffernutters. Fluffernutters were my sandwich of choice when I was growing up. Are you familiar with the delicacy of Fluffernutters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of my favorite things.
I was going to say, I grew up in Maryland and you're in Pennsylvania, so I think it's a Mideast kind of thing, or Middle Eastern, not Middle Eastern, a Mid-Atlantic kind of thing, because I brought it. I mentioned it down south and nobody has a clue. It's like, y'all don't know what you're missing.
Sometimes I'll just take the spoon and dip it into both the fluff and the peanut butter.
Yeah.
Without the bread.
So for those of you that are listening that have no idea what we're talking about, a Fluffernutter sandwich is a peanut butter sandwich made with peanut butter and the marshmallow fluff together. And it is exquisite.
It's perfect. You're welcome.
Yes.
We're gonna put in these recipes from now on. this month's recipe, the Fluffernutter.
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk about skin cancer. This is a QRS, but this is a big QRS. It's all the skin cancers and everything you need to know about them by Carl Garuba. He's the director and a professor in the PA program at the Dominican University of California, and Kelly Donkers, an assistant professor in the PA program at Chatham University. No conflicts of interest. And, okay, so guess what? Skin cancer, most common cancer diagnosis in the U.S., but often preventable. We've got the 3 main kinds, squamous, basal, and malignant melanoma. And the article kind of talks about them all together. I'm just going to break them down into their categories of basal, squamous, and malignant melanoma. Basal is the most common, usually on sun-exposed places. Risk is greater for men than women, and risk is fair-skinned, having used a tanning bed or a previous personal or family history of basal skin cancer. It's that dome or pearl-shaped lesion can be ulcerated, and it can be multilobular, and it can also have telangiectasias. They're a hallmark. And it also can be pigmented. So if you see something that's pigmented, doesn't mean it's not basal cell. You've got to have a biopsy. And then treatment is depending on the size and location and cell type, but excision is preferred for large tumors with well-circumcised borders on areas of the body that aren't high risk, but Mohs is better for high risk of reoccurrence areas of a cosmetic concern, larger tumors or tumors with poorly defined borders. I'm just thinking pearly when I'm thinking basal cell. So if you have a basal cell with poorly defined borders, whether it was pearly or not, then we're looking at Mohs. Basal cells less than 6 millimeters. And here I'm going to throw something in. I happen to know that a pencil eraser from the top of a pencil is about 5 millimeters. So if you need kind of a rule of reference in your mind, so it's a little bit larger than the pencil eraser on the tip of a pencil. If it's 6 millimeters, it can be considered for electrodesiccation and curettage if it's less than 6 millimeters. Okay, so squamous. That's the second most common type. It's similar risk for basal. Looks different than basal. This is a persistent ulceration, something that's just not healing, crusting, hyperkeratosis, scaly, erythema. Again, you have to biopsy to know if you have cancer or not. If it's a lesion that's smaller than 2 millimeters, which is tiny, a 4 millimeter excisional biopsy is usually enough. We're talking about biopsying. If it's larger or extends sub-Q, or if it's on the ear, lip, scalp, eyelid, or nose, then a 6 millimeter excisional biopsy is recommended. And replay that last sentence if you're going to take the quiz in this QRS. That's going to be important to you. Treat with excision. Mohs, electrodesiccation and curettage, or cryosurgery and radiotherapy. And then finally, the big bad wolf, melanoma, third most common but highest mortality, common in women over 40. They're at more increased risk because of their increased use of tanning beds. Now we know how terrible tanning beds are. I definitely was someone who's been in one before. It was just something that we did, and now we know better yet again.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah. We just, and as teens, they were like, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, mm-hmm. child. Go to that carcinogen. Mm-hmm. Oh, dear. Anyway, now we know. It's mostly seen in sun-exposed skin. I've heard of it in the eye, in the back of the eye. You can see it under nails, between digits. Strongest risk factors are multiple benign or atypical nevi, or personal or family history. You diagnose it with total excisional biopsy with narrow margins. Early and complete excision is the curative treatment. We know that it has a pretty good mortality, though. So if it's in situ, which means it's still in the dermis, excise with a 0.5 millimeter margin. If it's larger than that, it's going to be treated differently. We stage melanoma on the TNM, so that's tumors, nodes, and mets system, and use clinical pathology for staging that. And we want to use imaging and find any mets and do lymph node analysis. Super common. Everyone is exposed to UV light. Even when you're inside, you're exposed to UV light. And the article doesn't say this, but I'm telling you this. I was taught to use a full shot glass by my derm NP friend. Full shot glass of sunscreen. I didn't finish that thought. I just said full shot glass of sunscreen for a full body and then reapply regularly. So like every 4 hours, that's a lot more sunscreen than I think most people use. And this isn't just at the beach. This is like every day, all the time. We should be going through much more sunscreen. And Australia has that fun slip, slop, slap slogan. So slip on long sleeves, slop on sunscreen, and slap on a hat if you need to think about prevention a little bit more.
Yep, it's something that we don't think about. All the different times that we got bad sunburns when we were younger, the tanning beds, the times over the summer when we were in our early teens or late teens, early 20s, hanging out at the pool with our friends, trying to get that bronze Adonis look. And we got to be careful now.
Mm-hmm. You'll see those effects if you're not middle aged yet. You'll see them come.
Yep, absolutely. So the last one we're going to talk about is using ultrasound to diagnose long bone fractures, and this is by authors Alexandra O'Brien and Mohamed Musa. P.A. O'Brien practices in neurosurgery and orthopedic surgery at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester, Mass. And Dr. Musa is the program director of emergency medicine residency program and assistant professor of emergency medicine at the University of Toledo in Ohio. So quick and dirty with ultrasound on long bone fractures. Increased utilization of ultrasound in emergent and urgent care settings is really allowing us to look at things that maybe we wouldn't have used ultrasound before. We were kind of all taught if it's bone, you do the x-ray, it's easy to see. But then we're finding out x-rays take time, it's radiation exposure. Some places may not have x-ray on site, so you're sending your patients off to get the x-ray, then they're coming back. So we're starting to use ultrasound a little bit more for diagnosing long bone fractures. The technical consideration, so when you're looking at an ultrasound, and completely recognize the fact that the podcasting medium may not be the best for describing something that is visual, but what you're looking for is that bone is seen as a hyperechoic line on short axis, which means as you hold the probe perpendicular to the bone that you're looking at, you're going to see a hyperechoic line that is the bony cortex, and any disruption of that would then be a fracture. Now, the benefits of ultrasound is that it's fairly accurate. We'll get to some of the sensitivities and specificities at the end, but it is fairly accurate, comparatively speaking. There is a lower perceived pain score when imaging, so you got to remember, if somebody's got a fractured wrist, say they've got a colleague's fracture of the wrist, our radiology colleagues have to take that wrist and supinate it and pronate it and move it into position in order to get the films that they need, and that can be quite painful. Ultrasound, you put the probe on, and you scan over the area that's tender, but they can hold it in a position that is comfortable for them. It's also a lower wait time, 1.5 minutes for an ultrasound of a long bone fracture versus 27 minutes for radiographs. And so if you compound that over time, over a day, you're talking about potentially hours of wait time where you could be doing this from an ultrasound standpoint. The main limitation for all ultrasound studies is this is user dependent. one of the reasons why the adoption of bedside ultrasound has been slower than some of us would like, because it's a skill you have to learn and you have to get good at, because you're only as good as the images that you can procure. Whereas when we order an x-ray, we rely on our radiology colleagues to get the best film for us to be able to interpret. Now, the nice thing is the authors did go into a little bit about some studies that talked about training. There were several that looked about how to teach ultrasound for long bones, and it all revolved around some form of didactic instruction, which could be both in-person and online, as well as a practical hands-on instruction where they actually did the scans themselves. And the end result was that all of these studies pointed to a greater than 90% sensitivity and specificity after performing these trainings. So it's a modality that is does not have radiation, lowers the wait time in order to be able to diagnose, still has a greater than 90% sensitivity and specificity, and really could help your patients diagnose these fractures earlier and less painful than using traditional radiographs. But you have to get trained on it. You have to feel comfortable with it. And there is a little bit of user dependency that kind of goes with it. So I think we're going to see more and more articles of this come about with us being able to utilize ultrasound a little bit more at the bedside for things that maybe we didn't think about before.
Yeah. Point of care ultrasound POCUS is just blowing up in the PA world. And if you want to learn more, there's always opportunity to learn at the national conference at AAPA, which is coming up in May. So if you're thinking about going or not, and you want to learn more about point of care ultrasound, there's a lot of opportunities there for you to sign up. So something to think about. Yeah. But speaking of AAPA, Chris, we've got some more news from AAPA.
We do. So don't forget, the AAPA does have annual awards every single year. The nomination started on January 2nd. They are ending on February 17th. And the annual awards include PA of the Year, PA Student of the Year, Military Service, AAPA, PAEA Preceptor of the Year, Publishing, Outstanding Student Society, and the Eugene A. Stead Jr. Lifetime Achievement Award. So if you know a PA who you feel fits the bill for any of these, go ahead and nominate them. Get their word out, and hopefully they'll win.
If you're going to nominate someone else, you have to nominate them by February 10th. So do it fast, but do it. And if you're going to nominate yourself, which you certainly can do, all deadlines are February 17th. And you go to aapa.org/awards to do so.
So that's all we got for you for today.
But you can see us on Twitter.
We are all over social media. You can find me at PA_Made. Adrian's at The Art of EBM. Japa is at Japa Online for on both Twitter and Instagram. Thanks again to Harrison Reed, the associate editor of Japa. Actually, he is now the interim editor-in-chief of Japa, as Reamer Burchard has stepped down. So we apologize to Harrison. He is at Harrison Reed PA. Credits for sound and sound engineering is done by myself. And if you haven't subscribed to our feed on iTunes or Stitcher, give us a rating.
So until next time, see you later.
Bye.